Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 18th of October, Monday at 9, all things political. Before we get rolling with our guest, David Limbaugh, let me tell you that we had one whale of a fall membership drive, a great success. We raised over $1,025,000 from nearly 10,000 members to pay for our WPR programs, and we're welcoming more than 2,000 new members to Wisconsin Public Radio. So thank you very much for all of your support. I know it felt like a lengthy drive at times, but it was successful. It was mission accomplished. And thank you very much. It was very nice of you. So here we go. Full hour programs now. And our guest this hour for all things political is David Limbaugh. He is a political commentator. He is the brother of radio talk show host Rush Limbaugh, and he's an expert in law and politics who does a great deal of writing. He attended Southeast Missouri State University and the University of Missouri. He graduated with a degree in political science and then received his law degree from the University of Missouri Law School and was on the Missouri Law Review. He served in the National Guard from 72 to 78, taught business law at Southeast Missouri State, and has been on the Board of Trustees of the Southeast Missouri Hospital and is on the executive committee right now. And he writes extensively about politics. We're going to be welcoming phone calls for David Limbaugh. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And if you would like to send us an email, we're up and running with that today. That's talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Good morning, David. Thank you so much for being with us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Yeah, here we are 2 weeks from the election, 2 weeks from tomorrow. Give me your prognosis. Do you think we're going to see a Republican takeover of the House and the Senate, or just the House, or give me what you think is going to happen?
I think there's a good chance that they could take over the Senate as well, but no one knows at this point. The pollsters are saying both the House and the Senate are in play, and I think even conservative prognosticators are predicting a minimum of something like 55 House seats when they only need 39. And the Senate, of course, is much more debatable, and I think it's going to play out. But I think the voter intensity is such that conservatives, Republicans have a decided advantage, and I think the good money is on them regaining the majority in the Senate as well. But I'm not cocky about it. I just think that's what's going to happen.
Yeah. And what about the voter intensity? What is the reason for the dissatisfaction? Is it jobs mostly, would you say, David, or does it go beyond that?
No. Yes, it goes way beyond that. My book out, Crimes Against Liberty, chronicles all these things that the Obama administration has done in his 2 years as president, and people are horrified at how he is bankrupting America, how he's undermining our national security, how he's uprooting our American ideals. And I think it's not the economy stupid, it's America stupid. People are scared that they are not going to be able to bequeath to their kids and grandkids the same kind of America that was bequeathed to us by our ancestors. And so they want to take America back and restore its values and unleash its entrepreneurial spirit again and to reinvigorate its national security posture.
Should we see, and I can only imagine we're going to see a lot more gridlock, but should we see a Republican takeover? Tell me what the Republican agenda is. What changes would we see?
Well, of course, it's going to be tricky because regardless of whether they take back both houses, they still have a president in office who's a Democrat, a president hell-bent on pursuing an agenda that is destructive for America, that is statist, that is socialist, and who is not shy about bullying and lying and distorting things and painting Republicans as obstructionists. And so it'll be interesting to see what happens there. But I think their agenda, they've stated what their agenda is in general terms in the pledge, and it is to roll government back. Now, I don't think they go far enough, but they have stated that, you know, they're running on a national agenda as opposed to local, and they're trying to say that they are going to repeal or defund Obamacare and trying to slash government spending across the board, radical entitlement reform, trying to re-establish some of our national security posture, you know, getting rid of these, and then they can't do it by themselves, but their goal, of course, is to change these cockeyed ideas like Mirandizing terrorists on the battlefield and scrapping SDI, scrapping the Constellation program going to the moon. I mean, there's all kinds of things that they will oppose in due course, but I think the main ones are trying to defund Obamacare, trying to oppose this insane cap-and-trade initiative that Obama will probably try to get back to, the amnesty bill that he calls euphemistically comprehensive immigration reform, and just the overall reckless spending that he's engaging in. Those are the kinds of things, I think, that they will focus on.
Why do you call him a socialist?
Because I don't know of any increase in the state that he's not in favor of. I think he believes that government can do things better than the private sector. He believes in command control economies. He's a diehard believer in Keynesian economics. Even after he spent his $868 billion on his stimulus and it didn't work, he insists on spending $50 billion more. Instead of saying, recognizing it doesn't work, he's saying he underestimated the degree of the crisis that he inherited, even though he claimed it would only that unemployment wouldn't exceed 8% if we passed a stimulus, and it got above 10, and then it hovered between 9 and 10 cents. He just can't take personal accountability. He just can't digest the empirical evidence which proves him wrong, and he says we have to do more of it. And there's just no amount of redistribution he doesn't favor. He's constantly attacking capitalism and capitalists. He wants to redistribute wealth across the board. He always engages in class warfare and attacks the wealthy, the so-called wealthy, and denies that they even create jobs. That seems to be, you know, they used to have Democrats make fun of Republicans for trickle down. Well, he actually believes in trickle up. It's just an amazing thing. I mean, I don't see him sharing values that most Americans share. He says he's a fiercely committed to the free market, and he shows no evidence of that. Takes over companies and restructures them in his planned restructuring of Chrysler and GM, as I talk about in my book Crimes Against Liberty. He not only took over those countries and fired the executives, he tried to restructure them such that his union buddies who were unsecured would get a better deal than the secured creditors. And when they tried to object, he threatened to go public and slander their reputations. So I just think he's a top-down, tyrannical-type, dictatorial executive who believes that he's not constrained by the limitations imposed on chief executives in the Constitution.
You said earlier, David, that you believe that he is uprooting national security. What do you mean by that?
I thought I said uprooting American values and undermining our national security. I mean, when you take the position that the war on terror is virtually not a war, he's renamed it. The acts of terrorism are man-caused disasters or whatever, and this is an overseas contingency operation. When we don't allow ourselves to look into the jihadist background of Hassan, who murdered the 12 soldiers at Fort Hood, and you whitewash that report so as to sanitize it of his Islamo-fascist roots, our motives for doing the killing, and he wants to prosecute Bush-era CIA members who conducted enhanced interrogation operations, and even the lawyers who recommended that it was okay, who issued opinions that it was not torture, and he wants to undermine or he wants to dismantle our SDI, our Strategic Defense Initiative. He said, and I say on page 323 of my book, Crimes Against Liberty, America is still a world superpower, like it or not, as if there's anything not to like about this, the greatest and most benevolent nation in the history of the world, having power. He believes we've projected our power unfairly. He goes around the country apologizing for our supposed dismissiveness and arrogance and derisiveness, for consuming too much of the world's resources. This guy does not believe, I don't think, that America ought to vigorously fight terrorism. He thinks we ought to coddle tyrants. He turns his back on true democratic movements in the Honduras and in Iran. And he thinks that we basically cause terrorists to be recruited by saying bad things about them, by opposing their mosques. We're not being tolerant enough, and that's what causes jihadism. That's what causes otherwise peaceful Muslims to become mass murderers. You know, Osama bin Laden said that he was encouraged to attack us based on how we reacted at Mogadishu. We were a paper tiger, and that encouraged him, that incentivized him to attack us, as opposed to doing it because he was mad at us. We hadn't done anything to him before 9/11. What we've done is that we are infidels. It's not because of our policies. We are infidels, and he's an extreme Muslim who believes that infidels ought to be subjugated or killed. And that's what it's about. It's not about you can't rehabilitate or conciliate or make bread with people who want to kill you as a matter of sheer existence. I don't understand. But that's the approach I think he takes, and that's what he took to Cairo in his speech. And it's completely naive, and it's completely wrongheaded.
Let's go back to interrogation for just a moment. You talk about this as enhanced interrogation. There was legitimate concern, don't you think, about what may be going too far, that the line between enhanced interrogation and torture may not exist?
I don't know what you mean, the line may not exist, but let me say this. I don't deny that it's a reasonable point to debate, but I think the other side shouldn't deny that those techniques were only imposed three times, and they extracted actual, real-time, life-saving information so that we applied some tough interrogation techniques, and we actually got information that prevented a bombing in the L.A. airport, and we know this, and we got a bunch of information from those attacks. There was no permanent damage to the terrorist, who, by the way, is not very sympathetic figure. We're talking about this waterboarding. Again, I repeat, it was done three times. It was done with a ticking time bomb scenario. And even if it wasn't, I think on balance, it's justified to apply tough techniques to get information that will actually save lives. I don't even understand how it's debatable. I mean, I say it's debatable because I know the people on the other side, some of them at least, are intellectually honest about it. I think it's a semantic thing about whether it's torture. And by the way, the terrorists, the jihadists, don't even come under the Geneva Conventions anyway. But that's not saying I'm advocating torture, but I am advocating doing things that will save lives. And if it's a little tough, it's a little tough. But I love the fact that we were able to save American lives.
But we're America. Don't we stand for a different set of values?
So what? I mean, we do stand for a different set of values. And why do liberals have to keep apologizing for that? We obviously stand for different values. As I said a minute ago, we're the most benevolent nation in the history of the world. When we attack people, when we defeat foreign nations in war, we don't subjugate them. We liberate them, and then we rebuild them with our own money. I mean, we're the most humane people ever, but we can't just be fools and turn our backs on information that will save lives. Is that a great value? Is it a great value to say, if I knew I could apply waterboarding and that's the only way I could save someone's life, is it a good value, in your view, to not impose it and let people die? What kind of value is that?
Let's welcome phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655. David Limbaugh is our guest this hour, political commentator, author of Crimes Against Liberty and Tyranny, An Indictment of President Barack Obama. He is the brother of Rush Limbaugh. And let's take our calls, starting with Sue in Eau Claire. Hi, Sue.
Hello. I'm curious to know which of the things that we should be angry with President Obama for. Would it be the fact that he was unable to prosecute the bankers that pulled off this big scam in 2008 because the laws had been repealed that controlled banking regulations, or because he had to sign off on about $800 billion in bailout for the banks because they had lost a bunch of people's money? Or should we be angry with him because he started a jobs bill to try and get some confidence back in the markets because the whole economy was built on a lie for 3 to 4 years? I'm not sure which of those things that we are supposed to be angry at him about. Now, I know you're going to have your sugar-coated right-wing answers, and frankly, I'm a little shocked that you're on the radio as a semi-objective person, but I'd like to hear your answers.
I don't deny that I'm a conservative. I don't hold myself out as anything but a conservative, but I don't make up facts, and I didn't make up anything in my book, Crimes Against Liberty. But you're talking about the subprime mortgage crisis, which was largely caused by liberal policy, which insisted in affordable housing, making loans to people who couldn't afford them, and then bundling them and selling them in the secondary market. And it was an artificially created bubble by the government, not by so-called evil bankers. It was the government's policy. The government is who ought to be held accountable. Barney Frank, Chris Dodd, Obama, the rest of them, for refusing to, or for forcing banks and for passing laws that forced loans to people who can't make them. And you're talking about this jobs bill? Obama admitted, he has now audaciously admitted that there's no such thing as shovel-ready jobs when he insisted we pass $1 trillion. You're saying he passed this bill to ameliorate the situation? We had spent $700 billion on TARP. A prudent president would have come in and said, we can no longer bankrupt this country. We're going to have to tighten our belts. But he upped the ante and spent almost $1 trillion for something that didn't work. And now we know it didn't work, and he promised by his own standards it would keep unemployment below 8%. It went to 10%, above 10. It's hovered between 9 and 10% since. And instead of owning up to the failure of his policy, he said, I under-anticipated the urgency of the crisis. It took us 9 or 10 years to get in this mess. It's going to take us 9 to 10 years to get out. $868 billion didn't jumpstart the economy, but I'm expecting you to believe that 1/17 of that amount, i.e. $50 billion, will stimulate the economy. And I don't know what you mean by the economy being built on a lie. The Bush economy for 7 years was robust, and the entire time the Democrats were bad-mouthing it, saying how terrible it was. Unemployment was below 5%. He had reduced the deficit, notwithstanding some of his profligate spending. We had growth, economic growth, to the extent that his deficits were cut in half below $300 billion average prior to the final year when this market subprime bubble burst. His deficit, I think, in 2007 was $141 billion. Now we're talking 10 times that as a matter of course, as far as the eye can see. And if you look at Obama's budgets, even in the out years, he doesn't try to get the budget below $1 trillion. He's using that extraordinary circumstance of the crisis and TARP as an excuse to establish a new baseline, and instead of trimming our belts and tightening our belts, he's using it as an excuse, as a license to spend $1 trillion plus in perpetuity. That's why I'm mad at what he's doing. I would be crazy not to be mad at what he's doing. It's destroying our entire nation. It's bankrupting us. And our kids will have to be paying this off. You talk about him having good intentions. I failed to see him. But even if they are good intentions, it's not enough to justify sympathy for him when he's destroying the fiscal health of the nation.
Do you think, David, as many have suggested, that we were on the brink of a depression when he took office?
No. I mean, I don't think it was a depression. I think there was some kind of a financial catastrophe going on, where there could be runs on banks or whatever. I don't know. It was a very sophisticated deal. I certainly don't think we were on the on the on the brink of a depression, and we have, you know, we're approaching that now, maybe, or we will be if this doesn't stop this excess spending. But no, I clearly don't think we're on the brink of a depression.
Let's welcome more phone calls in a moment. David Limbaugh is our guest this hour, political commentator, author of Crimes Against Liberty and Tyranny, an indictment of President Barack Obama. Our phone number, thank you, Sue, for your call, is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, and our email address is talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second hour of our program today, we will be speaking with the star of Bagot, which is a documentary. It asks the question, is your life too plastic? David Limbaugh is our guest, political commentator, author of Crimes Against Liberty and Tyranny, an indictment of President Barack Obama. David is the brother of Rush Limbaugh. And let's go to Gary next from Merrill. Hi, Gary.
Yes, hello. Wonderful guest. Could you talk somewhat about the rules of engagement for the young kids fighting over there in Afghanistan that puts more restrictions on them than a police officer would have probably in any city in the United States? Thank you.
I'm not even sure I understood that question. Do you understand it, Kathleen?
Yeah, I'm not aware of this. The rules of engagement for our soldiers that are putting a great deal of restrictions on them. I'm not sure
he's saying. Well, yeah. I mean, I couldn't quite hear him because the audio was going in and out.
Sorry.
But I think what his point is then that we're not engaging in this in a warlike manner, but in a law enforcement manner, and imposing all these restrictions on our own side, and, like the Miranda warnings, which I thought, by the way, Kathleen, was a scrapple face satire when I read it. I mean, the idea that you would Mirandize jihadists on a battlefield as if they're criminal suspects is beyond reckless. But, I don't know all the details about the other restrictions imposed on our troops in the battlefield, but whatever they are, they're not healthy to the extent that we tie their hands and don't allow them to fight a war as if it is a war, and it certainly is a war.
It's been going on for a long time. We're approaching 10 years now. Do you see an end game in Afghanistan?
Well, I defer to the military chiefs over there, and I certainly don't think it's smart to set an arbitrary deadline like Obama has, that we're going to get out in 6 months and telegraph that signal to the enemy that we're going to leave regardless of what the condition is and just give them an incentive to wait us out and then take the country back over. And you can debate whether we should have gone into these countries and how much nation building we ought to do and all that, but I think it was a matter of our national interest and a reasonably perceived national interest, and I think we ought to stay until we get the situation better stabilized. And I don't know what that is. But you know, you can't just put a time limit on it. It's not good. It's one of those things that we don't enjoy having to do. But it would be worse, I think, to leave and allow the terrorists to get their foothold and reestablish their dominance there, from which they can attack us again.
Some have said if we hadn't gone into Iraq, Afghanistan would have been taken care of by now. Do you agree with that?
No, of course. The liberals always said that we were spread too thin. The real bottom line is the Democrats supported the Bush claim that there were WMD in Iraq until they saw that he was a popular wartime president, so they retrospectively changed their story. Kennedy, Hillary Clinton, all of them were railing about WMD that Saddam Hussein had, and then they, after the fact, said that Bush fabricated the story. It was the most shameless display of a party degenerating into moral bankruptcy I've ever seen. And then they started saying that they loved Afghanistan, that if we had just not diverted to Iraq, we should have stayed after the real terrorists and pursued Osama bin Laden. Well, the truth was, we didn't let Osama bin Laden go like they claimed. They claimed we had him trapped and we didn't pursue him. Tommy Franks, who was a commander on the ground at the time, said that's utterly false. It's another fabrication of the liberals. We knew that they weren't in favor of pursuing Afghanistan vigorously either, that it was just another excuse, just another cudgel that they could use to beat Bush over the head with, to pretend they were after the true cause, the true just cause in Afghanistan, to show how, by contrast, how bad Iraq was. Now they get there, now they're handling this Afghanistan thing, and they don't, after using it against him, the Republicans in the campaign, now they're wanting to get out of there as quickly as they can. They're not for prosecuting any of these theaters of war, in my view, generally speaking.
But no matter what your thoughts were, the truth of Iraq is that there were no weapons of mass destruction, which makes that war somewhat problematic, don't you think?
Well, you know, it wasn't just the weapons of mass destruction. It was the fact that he'd violated all the UN resolutions, that he was openly defying us, that he was still a threat to... I think he was a threat because he was leading us to believe that he had WMD. That all the intelligence agencies in the world that were credible, that were worth their salt, believed he had WMD. So, are we supposed to be perfect? The fact that our intelligence agencies didn't get it right, assuming they didn't get it right, and he wasn't able to transport him out of there, assuming that he didn't have them. He was leading us to believe he had them. Our intelligence people thought he had them. Why is it problematic if we acted on the only intelligence that we had at the time, that even Democrats believed? I mean, that's easy for them after the fact to paint a picture that Bush should have known things that they didn't know and that our best intelligence agents didn't know. Why is it problematic? It's problematic if you hold yourself up to a perfect standard, but not if you're acting on the best information you have, which I submit is the only thing you can do.
It's problematic, I think, because a lot of people died.
Well, do you think I'm saying that that's not bad? But we also dethroned Saddam Hussein, and Iraq is a freer nation now. But we didn't, you know, indiscriminately kill people over there. They're the ones who did it. I mean, we're not the look at the way they were subjugating there. I mean, do you believe all these figures that the left has put out about the ungodly amounts of people that we killed over there? I mean, do you all believe that kind of propaganda, that hundreds of thousands of people were killed at the hands of the Americans?
I don't think we actually know, do we?
Well, I think it's more prudent to believe that it didn't occur. I mean, those figures have been greatly distorted and inflated. But, I mean, we act on the information that we have, and the policy we had at the time in our comprehensive war against terror was that if nations that are aiding and abetting terrorists and those that are perceived to be a threat to us are our enemies. And Bush and his people believe that Saddam Hussein was violating all the UN resolutions, was defiant about it, and it was continuing to move forward with his chemical, biological, and nuclear programs, and believed that if we didn't do something about it, that it would end up gravely threatening our national security. War is never good, so I'm not going to defend war as something that's desirable. It's only, an undesirable circumstance that you accept grudgingly.
Let's go to Tina David from Sparta. Hi, Tina.
Hi. When I first voted, I signed up as a Republican, had my card. Both me and my husband are retired Army. We have a small farm in Wisconsin. And, you know, first we sort of drifted to liberal when, you know, with George Bush in. And listening to guys like this, it's like you become a yellow dog Democrat. You just automatically pull the Democratic lever. I mean, I like Dole, and, you know, even Nixon was paranoid, but he wasn't barking mad. And these guys come on, and they just rave. I mean, reality isn't there. It just rave, and if you contradict them, they rave louder. I just don't know what to say when you listen to people like this. There isn't a discussion. I mean, I've lived in Germany. I've lived in Europe, and the stuff they're talking about is non-existent. I've been in the military. I was in for Iraq 1. I have friends that were in for Iraq 2. Good grief, guys. It's not reality.
What are we talking about here? You're talking about ranting. I mean, you haven't said one specific thing. What have I said that, if you're talking about me, I assume you are, what have I said that isn't supportable?
The medical thing is probably the best thing, except possibly completely getting rid of HMOs, insurance companies, and simply putting on our big boy pants and being a government that provides health care for their people, like every other civilized nation does. And it works out really, really well, and it does not take away anybody's personal liberties or freedom.
Outrageously wrong. It doesn't work anywhere. If you're talking about nationalized health care, although I didn't even think we were talking about that.
Well, let's talk about it.
But that's what's amazing. You're accusing me of talking about things. I'm glad to talk about it, but I haven't ranted about Obamacare. It's a disaster. Everything that he said about it, almost everything he said about it, trying to cram it down our throats, was not true. It's not deficit neutral. It's going to be a complete burden, a tremendous burden on our economy. It is going to restrict our freedoms. It restricts our choice. People are already being separated from their chosen doctors and their chosen insurance companies, which he claimed wouldn't happen. He claimed that it wasn't. He claimed he wouldn't have a public option. We're seeing that it's going to be a public option soon. He claimed that that there are more uninsured than there are, and he said he's forcing people to buy insurance. It's going to cause prices to go up, and our choices to be constricted, and our quality of medical care to go down. And they're already starting to talk about allocating. There was an allocating and rationing care. There was an article the other day in National Review Online about some 63-year-old man who took a test last year, a radiological test, and there was a tumor or something, and they said, come back in a year. The insurance company covered it. He came back in the year, and they said, we can't cover this to see your follow-up to see if it's now malignant, because the mandates of Obamacare at the other end of the spectrum, covering kids and others, are such that we cannot pay for this.
What is the alternative, David?
The alternative is the proposals that the Republicans have made to reinstitute market forces into the healthcare industry. I mean, there's a lot of problems with it, but a lot of these problems were caused by divorcing the price mechanism from the equation, so that you, when you have these tax laws that favor employer-provided health care, so that people go to doctors and don't have any idea what they're spending, and so it seems visibly free to them, there's no demand-supply forces working. And that's one thing they should do, is to change those discriminatory laws so that people who are not employed, who have private insurance coverage, can either deduct, or that those who do cannot deduct, so that that's a level playing field, and people will start spending their own money on insurance on medical care, and knowing what they're spending, and not having all these mandates that we limit our ability to have competition because you can't cross state lines to get health care. There are these kind of top-down mandates imposed against us. There's all kinds of market reforms that Paul Ryan and others have proposed. That when the market, if you reinstate market forces, you're more likely to get a better care at a better price.
What about her point, though, which is a legitimate point? When you look at the United Kingdom or Canada or France or Japan or South Africa or so many countries in the world, democracies, they all have a single payer plan. They cover everybody. What's wrong with that?
Because it can't work. You can't force everyone to be covered and not have the not have the market forces work. Socialism never works. When you have top down command control economies, you spread the misery, you spread poverty, you reduce the quality. I mean, it doesn't work in Britain. This is the best healthcare system in the world. All the people from other countries that try to come to this country with serious illness. We have much better treatment and research on cancer and heart disease, the biggest killers that exist in the world. And I mean, I don't even understand how people can claim that these systems work. There's all kinds of ridiculous waiting lines in Britain and Canada. You just can't compare them favorably in other countries to the health care we have here.
Well, you can if you don't have health care, right? I mean, if you don't have health care, it doesn't make any difference how great the health care is.
There are not the numbers that we're talking about are exaggerated. And people do have health care here in emergency rooms. They can't be denied health care. And millions upon millions of people in this country could afford health care and choose not to because they're banking on their own good health. And so millions of those people and other millions more are illegal immigrants or not American citizens that we're talking about. You to cover those that are truly not covered, you could have some kind of a safety net expanded with vouchers or whatever that would cover those who are truly – oh, by the way, there's another category of people who are entitled to government benefits who do not avail themselves of it. We know that. So there's an estimated something like 8 to 10 million in the United States who are truly capable of getting – or unable to get – insurance, unable to afford it, and can't get it. So I think you could expand the safety net to cover those. Conservatives are not heartless. They just don't believe in smothering the market and decreasing the quality for everyone and reducing our freedoms and allowing the government to come in and impose controls over all aspects of our society through the vehicle of nationalized health care. By the way, this Donald Berwick, who Obama appointed, has said that he believes that nationalized health care is a primary essential vehicle to redistribute wealth. It's not just the rantings of paranoid conservatives who are fearful of the further reaches of Obamacare than just medicine. His own appointees have acknowledged that we're going to use it to redistribute wealth. That's socialism.
So
that's what we're opposed to.
You're concerned that this health care reform that we have now is just a little removed from a government running health care entirely, a public option.
I think
completely.
It's inevitable that we're going to end up with government-run health care because you're forcing insurance companies to be public utilities. When you say that they have to cover pre-existing conditions, for example, they're no longer a health insurance company. They're no longer assessing risk, which is what insurance companies do with actuarial tables, and they have people take people's premiums in exchange for paying their claims, but they have to evaluate in advance. Life insurance companies do it. All insurance companies do it. That's the way the business works. When you force them to pay for things, then they're no longer an insurance company. They're a public utility. And when you control what doctors can do, they're going to have these boards that actually tell doctors what kind of care that they should administer in order to get the best reimbursement. This is not fictitious. This is actually what's going to happen. So that you have the government telling us, the government that is not an expert in health care, telling doctors what care they ought to administer. You just cannot get the best result in any industry by a command-control model. And we've learned that. The history of the world should tell us that. That's what one of the many things that makes the United States so unique is its market system, which provides the most for the most, generally speaking.
Except that one thing for me, and then we'll go back to phone calls. If you have a pre-existing condition, and a lot of people do, and the insurance companies won't cover that because they can't make as much money, then what do you do if you're somebody who has a pre-existing condition? A lot of people have gone bankrupt. They've tried to gather money from their friends to have operations in other countries. I mean, isn't it a matter of human decency?
Well, like I said a minute ago, I'm in favor of expanding the safety net to cover those that are, I mean, to provide for those who truly fall under the cracks. But I want to do it in a way that it does not destroy the entire free market healthcare system, which we're well on the way to doing. But when Obama was ranting against insurance companies with civil rights language, saying that they were discriminating against people with pre-existing conditions, I want to point out to you for a minute the fundamental dishonesty of that. These insurance companies had contracts with people. That's what insurance is about, contracts with people or employers that say what they're supposed to cover in exchange for the money they're getting paid in the form of premiums. They're not to be covering pre-existing conditions. So when they don't cover them as a matter of contract, they're not discriminating illegally. They're just fulfilling the contract as it is written. So when Obama says that they're discriminating, he's slandering people, companies, for doing merely what the contract says. If they were required to cover pre-existing conditions, they would go bankrupt. And he admitted as much when he said, when he was trying to get support for his mandatory coverage provision, he said, "We can't possibly make insurance companies cover pre-existing conditions unless we mandate coverage. Otherwise, they'll go bankrupt." And yet, he had been saying the months before the exact opposite. So it's fundamentally dishonest. But we're not suggesting that. I mean, what do you suggest? I mean, we have suffering. Any system, you're going to have suffering. You're never going to eradicate the poor. The position of the conservative is that you're going to have fewer poor and much less poverty with a free market system than you do with socialism, because socialism reduces the pie and spreads the misery.
Okay, let's welcome more phone calls, and we'll do that in a moment. David Limbaugh is our guest, political commentator, author of Crimes Against Liberty and Tyranny, an indictment of President Barack Obama. He is the brother of Rush Limbaugh, and we're welcoming phone calls for all things political today. Our phone number, thanks, Tina, for your call, is 800-486-8655, and our email address is talk@WPR.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Returning to your phone calls, Will in Windsor is next. Hi, Will.
Yeah, thank you. Your guests have been so over the map with things that are not factual. And I'll go to rules of engagements. I'm a combat veteran. And what he is saying is the same stories that were told about Vietnam, that our hands were tired. We didn't win in Vietnam because we couldn't win in Vietnam. Because the people there were fighting for their country. We were there because we were sent there. He go on to talk about Iraq, and he doesn't give any history about that region. He talked about Mogadishu and doesn't give any history. It seemed as though he would preface his statements on some of the things that happen that may create the problems that we have in this country throughout the world because of our own actions, not to justify that those actions that we cause are true. For one, if he remember Mosaddegh, what happened in that region, and why should people trust us as a country to lead them to democracy? He also extended his conversation on the WMD. Sure, we knew there were WMD there, and we knew it because Rumsfeld took them there in the 80s when they had Saddam Hussein attack Iran. We knew they were there. We knew they were inert. But yet, no one spoke out except Amnesty International and other groups when people were talking about Saddam Hussein killing all those people. So it's ridiculous for one to come on and try to justify what has happened in this country because of this country's own actions. And then to go to that part about health care. Health care throughout the world is better. He hasn't given one fact to disapprove or disprove what people believe, rather than say that there's something wrong with those that believe that health care is better in other parts of the world.
All right, let's get a response.
Well, no, he's the one who didn't give facts. I said, and I cited my book, Crimes Against Liberty, the statistics that show we are ahead in cancer and heart, the two biggest killers. We're ahead of all the other countries in the world. I did not, as he suggested, just like the other caller, on red herring, saying said we didn't apply the rules of engagement. I was just responding to the caller saying if we don't, then we should. I didn't make any allegation about whether we do or not. His point about the things that about Vietnam, which really has nothing to do with anything in my book or anything else that's remotely recent, he's saying we lost in Vietnam because we weren't fighting for their country and they were. That is so outrageous. That's liberal revenge. I can't let that go. The communists were trying to take over South Vietnam. It wasn't their country. They were being forced, supported by Russia and the Russian Soviet communists and the Chinese communists from the north coming in trying to take over, and we wouldn't have lost if we hadn't abandoned the South Vietnamese after we left, and we allowed that bloodbath to occur in Cambodia and Laos and South Vietnam because we abandoned it. But it was not because we're it's not our country. Whether we should have gone in or not is one thing, but I don't think we would have lost had we not abandoned them at the end. It was
okay.
A matter of our motivation for fighting.
Let's go back to 2010 for a moment. What do you think of the Tea Party movement? Would you say that you're a member of it, David?
Well, I don't know that you have card-carrying membership, but I'm a supporter of it. I mean, yes, I think the Tea Party movement is about watchdogging government. It's trying to bring government to a more reasonable level to reduce the size of government, and now they're worried about what Obama is objecting to, what Obama is doing to expand government and to financially bankrupt us, and so they're trying to roll that back, and they're supporting candidates who will. But at the same time, I think they're also serving as watchdogs against establishment Republicans who will not also toe a more fiscally responsible line.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's go to phone calls, more of them. Rich in Rhinelander, hi.
Good morning. David, thanks for being on the program. I was raised an anti-communist. My father was born in a captive nation, a Soviet Socialist Republic. He came to America and was naturalized. I think you've correctly identified that American people are angry at big government. What I think you have failed to identify is that the American people are also sophisticated enough to distinguish between concepts like trade unionism, fair wage scales, and big business decimating American jobs by offshoring them, shipping them overseas. And what we have essentially right now with the bailing out of banks and big businesses is socialism for the wealthy and heavy taxation for the rest of us, much of it based on Republican policies. David, the last time I checked, China is still a communist nation, and American business has exploited Chinese labor, and every label on every good that I purchase, whether in the great state of Wisconsin or elsewhere in America, for a good that's made in China, should bear the label made in communist China, because it is still communist, and American corporations have made friends with communists.
All right.
And I think you are ignoring that fact.
David.
Well, I mean, somebody can call up and just bring up all kinds of things that we're not talking about. I don't know. I'm also ignoring, you know, the subjects of education and sex and other things we're not talking about because we're not talking about them. You know, but I just have to respond to one thing. Heavy taxation, socialism for the wealthy. The lower half of the income earners in America don't even pay taxes. The top 10% pay some 60% or 90%. I can't remember what the statistics. They're unbelievably skewed toward the top income earners paying the tax. And liberals who continue to engage in this untrue class warfare, unfair class warfare, saying that the rich don't pay their fair share is beyond amazing to me.
I would have to disagree that the lower half of the income earners in this country don't pay taxes.
I said income taxes. At income taxes. They don't pay income taxes. Almost 40-something percent do not pay income taxes. I'm not talking about payroll taxes. I'm talking about income taxes. It's a fact. That's so Googleable. Just Google it.
All right. I will Google it.
Please don't leave with the suggestion that I'm making that up. That's been common knowledge.
All right, I'm not.
Okay.
I want to talk about you and your brother for a moment, if you don't mind. Are you buddies?
Yes, very much.
And do you have other siblings?
No.
It's us. Were your parents conservative?
Of course.
Well, you know, there can be some rebellion going on against what your parents think. You know?
Yeah. That's... No, my dad was a very strong conservative.
Uh-huh. Well, thank you very much, David, for being with us.
And thank you for having me.
David Limbaugh, our guest, political commentator, author of Crimes Against Liberty and Tyranny, an indictment of President Barack Obama. He is a commentator. He's also a lawyer. He joined us by phone today from Missouri. I guess you pronounce it different ways depending on whether or not you live there. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for producing this hour, and thanks to Chrissy as well for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. We have news coming up. We also want to thank you once again for our fall membership drive, because I haven't talked to you since I ended my part in this last Thursday. We just had a whale of a drive. We received more than $1,025,000. So this service is obviously very important, as it should be to many of you. Thank you so much. News coming up, and we'll return.